Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on. So last week, I talked a lot about the UAW strike, and it's now in its second week. And at this point, the public opinion polls show that 75% of the people support the auto workers in their demand for a, quote, record profits, meaning a record contract. And I went over the demands last time. I won't do that this time. But what we're hearing is that Ford has conceded a lot of things that the union is demanding. But GM and Stellantis are holding tight to their position. So yesterday, the union expanded their strike to 38 more GM and Stellantis plants. These are mostly smaller auto parts plants. So there are a total of 41 plants on strike. It's only 5% of the workforce. So the union has a lot more they can throw into this to pressure the automakers to come to terms. And I talked with a retired auto worker in Detroit, Diane Feely, earlier this week. And she said the auto workers' spirits are high. And she actually posted a strike report that we should get posted in the chat, which has a list of the plants that are now being struck since yesterday. And it covers most areas of the country so that, you know, many of you could go out and support the workers. And those workers, particularly at the smaller auto part plants, would really appreciate folks coming to the picket lines and showing their support. So we'll keep an eye on that. Meanwhile, the far-right Republicans are shutting down the government. How long it's going to last, it's hard to tell at this point. But one thing I do know, it's going to hurt them in the 2024 election. I can remember it's happened every time since the Gingrich Republican Congress in 1995 and again in 1996 forced a shutdown. And I can remember how angry even conservative people, Republicans, were that the government couldn't stay open and, you know, provide basic services that they expected. You know, whether it was, you know, getting something straightened out with Social Security on their checks or a public park in a national park being open. You know, they planned a trip and suddenly they show up at the park and it's closed. Things like that just really anger people. And so every time Republicans do this, it hurts them, but they keep doing it. And it's amazing that they can still win elections. But between gerrymandering, the Electoral College, and a whole lot of built-in biases in our electoral system, which we talked a lot about how those need to be changed with things like ranked choice voting and proportional representation, you know, they still are able, with a minority position in the electorate, to maintain a lot of power, including right now in the House where the crazies are running the clown show. So, I don't know, next week we, you know, may have a government shutdown. So this week, we're just wrapping up Climate Week. And I went to that march in New York City on Sunday and exceeded expectations, 75,000 people, according to the organizers and, you know, mainstream media like the AP are using that number. I don't know how many were there. It was a lot of people. I ended up marching at the front with the Ukrainian climate activist Svetlana Romanko, who we've had on this podcast. And she, you know, asked us to be in touch about what would happen this week. And so I had the honor of marching with her. The organizers put her at the front of the march with the indigenous contingent and where some of the speakers were marching. And she asked me to accompany her to help carry her signs and banners. And I have to say, she was very well received. One Native woman came up to her, and she was wearing that traditional embroidered Ukrainian shirt. And the woman was looking at it and came up, and then she saw the Ukraine signs. And she said, "Yes, land back," you know, which is the slogan that indigenous people around the world have been using since 2018 when it started here in North America after those mass graves at the boarding schools for Indian children, a lot of them were uncovered. And so, you know, they get it. And she was well known. I mean, a lot of the climate activists knew her, like Vanessa Nakate, who's from Uganda. She's sort of the Greta Thunberg of Africa. She's organized Fridays for Our Future and a whole lot of other things there, fighting that pipeline going through East Africa, that fossil fuels pipeline. You know, it was fun for me being up front. Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein, who were covering the march as journalists, you know, saw Svitlanka and, you know, got a chance to thank Naomi Klein for her book, Doppelganger, which explores how and why and what to do about progressive-minded people who have gone down these conspiracy rabbit holes, you know, from COVID-19 to the Kremlin's narratives about Ukraine, and ended up allied with far right on those questions. She uses Naomi Wolf, with whom she's been confused, who was known as kind of a liberal feminist. She wrote a book called The Feminist Mystique, or The Beauty Mystique, in the early 1990s. But she's gone over to the far right. She's a regular on Steve Bannon's podcast and on Tucker Carlson. And, you know, it's all about conspiracy. So I read the book. I listened to an audiobook driving to and from the march. How do I get this up there? There. Everything's backwards. So that's what the book looks like. I just got the hard copy today. So I'm actually going to go back through it and read the hard copy closely, because, you know, from what I was listening, there's a lot of insight in there and how this strange phenomenon has happened, where through this conspiracy mindset, a lot of people have traveled from the left to the right. And it's something that's hard to understand, but I think this book actually does a good job in helping us think about that. So the march demands were focused on the Biden administration: stop approvals of new fossil fuel projects, stop fossil fuel drilling on public lands, declare a climate emergency, and provide for a just transition. The signage provided by the organizers, you know, focused on those demands, but I have to say the speakers did not so much. They tended to be people aligned with progressive Democrats. That's why Jamal Bowman and AOC were the only elected officials who spoke. Cornel West did speak, but it was at the opening rally, and he was presented as a faith leader, not a green presidential candidate. And his speech invoked, you know, his Christian radical tradition as the base for which, you know, we should all fight. And he fights fossil fuels and corporate greed. So when we got to the final rally, I was irritated right away when the MC introduced herself as a proud member of the Working Families Party, which is really an adjunct of the Democratic Party here in New York, especially where they routinely cross endorse Democrats. And then when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got to her speech, I was irritated again, because she boasted that her first bill introduced when she went in Congress in 2019 was the Green New Deal, quote, which demanded a 10-year timeline. And I'm wondering, what the hell is she talking about? 10-year timeline for what exactly? Because actually, her Green New Deal legislation, which was really just a non-binding resolution, and it has never been voted on, it called for a 31-year deadline from that time for, quote unquote, net zero, not real zero emissions, by 2050. Of course, net zero means to the fossil fuel industry, we can keep burning fossil fuels as long as we capture and sequester it. So that was one of many weaknesses or retreats from the Green New Deal that the Green Party had been talking about the whole previous decade is our signature issue. For example, that non-binding Green New Deal does not call for ending new fossil fuel projects or banning fracking. Ending new fossil fuel projects is one of the demands of this demonstration. It didn't call for deep cuts in the military budget to help fund the Green New Deal like the Greens have. Net zero instead of real zero. And then, of course, they extended the deadline. So, and we know here in New York that she got the Green New Deal idea from the Green Party, because her campaign manager, V.G. Ramos, had managed a Green candidate's campaign the previous year where the Green Party's Green New Deal was a central feature. So, but AOC's never acknowledged that. And then she went on to say, since then, when she introduced the bill, we have organized and hit some milestones. Here in New York, organizers won commitments to 100% renewables by 2040. Let me stop there. 2040 is not a 10-year deadline. And that's only for the power sector, which is only about a quarter of the carbon emissions in New York State. And then she went on to say, we've made sure new buildings will be fully electric. That takes place in a few years. That's true. Ensured that not only will new energy be renewable, which we really haven't done, but it will be available as public democratically controlled goods for our most vulnerable communities. And that is not true. There was a bill passed called Build Public Renewables, but that bill deleted the most important clause in it, which would have given the New York Power Authority the right of first offer and first refusal for any request for proposals for a new fossil fuel energy project. If that clause was in there, NYPA, the New York Power Authority, would have had to turn down a project before private companies could do it. Now, NYPA can only do it if the private sector decides it's not profitable. And that's what we call lemon socialism. That clause was obviously deleted at the insistence of the Democratic Party leadership, which is indentured to private industry, including the renewable energy industry. So, and as far as, you know, what did she call it? Public, public democratically controlled. Well, not really. There was another bill that didn't pass called the New York Utility Democracy Act, which would have converted all power distribution utilities in New York State to public power utilities controlled by democratically elected utility boards. So she's claiming we did something that we haven't done. And you know what irritated me, instead of being up there when she had the audience and exhorting us to demand more, she's kind of telling us we already won, at least here in New York. And he was really boasting about what progressive Democrats had done. And so we're in a situation where AOC and Bernie Sanders and the rest of the progressive Democrats have already endorsed Biden without making any demands on him. And in the context, in that context, I don't think Biden is feeling much heat from this march. Even though some of the demands are focused at him, everybody, you know, Biden knows they're all going to vote for him. And then no speaker, you know, talked about eco-socialism, need for an eco-socialist alternative. Although Cornel West's press release about Climate Week, you can look it up on his website, did call for the nationalization of the fossil fuel industry. And he had an earlier press release calling for that. But that was really not, you know, prevalent. I didn't see any signage, or really didn't see anybody calling for that in this march. And that's the state of the climate movement. It's really the state of the broad progressive movement in this country. It's about making demands on the existing power structure, which basically means lobbying the Democrats, rather than changing the system, restructuring the power. And of course, that's why we need the Green Party. So before we get to question and answer, I just want to mention that tomorrow morning, 11 Eastern time, we're going to have a debate on socialists and the 2024 election that I will be participating in. It's put on by this Marx Mail listserv, and I'll be debating. Some of these Marxists are not for independent political action in 2024. So that's at 11 a.m., and we have a link to the where you register for that if you want to take that in. But, you know, I'm going to argue that if we don't show up and run our own candidates, we disappear. And instead of offering a radical alternative to what we've got, we end up supporting the lesser evil. As you know, stop the greater evil, that's understandable, but if we don't present an alternative, the lesser evil's preparing the ground for the greater evil, because they always march to the right. Biden's doing that right now, whether it's immigration policy or that terrible debt ceiling deal, and on and on. More police, 100,000 more cops. I mean, he's moving to the right, and without a left out there, the whole politics shifts to the right. And so one thing I'll be saying is green candidates don't spoil elections. We improve elections. And I'll give some good examples of that. But I won't tell you all that now. Maybe you can tune in tomorrow. So I'm looking forward to your questions and comments. Lomboy Wilson, it would be helpful and instructive if I would discuss the West campaign. Well, I can tell you what I know. I've talked to him about his campaign. I did that in June, late June. I organized a briefing for him with a Ukrainian socialist about the war. We have scheduled, and Cornell is understandably very busy, so we don't have dates for these, but he and that socialist, Dennis Pilash from Ukraine, are going to come on this podcast and talk about the Ukraine war. He's agreed to get a briefing from some Greens that have long experience fighting for proportional representation and ranked choice voting. And he's agreed to come on a radio program with Harvey Wasserman, who has this Green grassroots election protection podcast that Progressive Democrats of America basically sponsor. It's on the Progressive Radio Network. But, you know, he's having trouble finding room in his schedule. So that's been, you know, my involvement with him. I did talk to him last week or exchange emails, and, you know, he said he's looking for a time, but he hasn't got one yet. So now, from what I know, Peter Dow has taken over as campaign manager from Jill Stein. Peter has long experience as on the messaging end of campaigns. I mean, going back to the Clinton campaign in 2016. And I think before. So I think he's good at that stuff. I wonder if he's good at, you know, raising money, getting a budget together, hiring staff, managing the staff, and doing the field operation a good campaign should have. I'm not saying he can't do it. I'm just saying I don't know. I think, you know, getting the organization together, I'm concerned about that. I'm hearing from people, you know, contacting the campaign. Campaign's not getting back to them. Have questions about the ballot access strategy. I mean, here in New York, we probably got the hardest ballot access problem. I mean, I haven't heard from their ballot access guy, although I know he knows me and knows my phone number. So I don't know what else to tell you. I think, you know, his messaging's good. I really appreciated him pushing back against Jimmy Dore, and that some of you may have seen that. He was on the Jimmy Dore show, and Jimmy Dore is telling him not talk about racism and white supremacy and sexism and, you know, trans rights and so forth, because it, quote unquote, divides the working class. And, you know, Cornell really pushed back against that, and I appreciated that, because, damn, you're not going to have the working class united if we're divided by racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia. So I think Cornell's got a good position on that, and I really appreciated that. And, you know, the positions he's taken, I think are good. He's more of a person that inspires and states values than focuses on policy. I'm kind of wonky that way. I'm probably at the other extreme, but, I think he gets across to a lot of people. I mean, some people he's a Christian socialist, and he really comes from that faith tradition, and, you know, that's what he talked about at the climate march as a faith leader. And he was in the faith contingent, which was a couple blocks back from me. So I didn't see him at the march, although if you look at that link, I don't know if it got on the chat. I did a report on my experiences at the march. There are links to Cornell's speech video and there's a lot of stuff on here already. Well, anyway, that should go up at some point. And you can look at his press release. So off the top of my head, that's pretty much what I can tell you. But, you know, if people have more specific questions they think I might know more about, please ask. A. Jones, 35. You cannot have a united working class until you address civil rights issues. Amen. And that's what Cornell was trying to tell Jimmy Dore, but Jimmy Dore wasn't having it. He's one of these, Dore is one of these guys that's, I call him the post-left populace. And they're aligning with the right on these questions of what they call identity politics. You know, people form around their oppressed identities to deal with their oppression. And people like Dore think they're trying to be privileged or something. I think it's Dore that's being divisive, not the people fighting racism and for the civil rights of everybody. Hey, Jones, will Chris Hedges have any role in the West campaign or the West administration? I know Chris Hedges is one of the people that convinced Cornell when he first said he was coming out with the People's Party, speaking of post-left, that he needs to go with the Greens, at least to get on a ballot. And Chris has had him on his podcast, has had Cornell West on his podcast. But any formal role, I don't know. I know they know each other. They're both kind of Christian-based people, so I think they have resonance there. But exactly, you know, how close that relationship is in terms of the campaign, I just don't know. Ashley R., how do you officially respond to your candidate's tax evasion and dodging of child support? Well, I don't officially respond, but I know what he said is he's taking care of the tax evasion and the child support thing is not real. He's been supporting his children, and that may be a record-keeping mistake. And he's, you know, basically said, you know, I'm guilty, I apologize, and I'm getting it fixed. That's what Cornell's been saying. So that's the best I can tell you. Blonde Boy Wilson, regarding trans rights, what is the party position on gender affirmation for minors? The Green Party platform, I have to go back and look to see what it says about the trans issue in detail. I know when the party kicked out the Georgia Green Party, which was anti-trans, and, for having that position. And I would just say for myself, I defer to the healthcare providers in terms of, you know, how to handle minors going through this issue. And I don't know what the Zach Party position is on that. And gender affirmation, I guess that means, you know, affirming that people that think they are or might be trans should be treated with respect and help, rather than condemning them. So that's about the best I can tell you. Michael Lavery, Howie, the New York State presidential ballot initiative for third parties is crazy. How can we fix these signature requirements and fees? Well, fees are not the issue in New York. It's the requirement to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days. That's now the hardest petition for a statewide office, including president, of any state in the country. Particularly, the absolute number is not the highest, but the time frame makes it the most difficult. And I've looked around the world, and the only comparable petition I can find is if you want to run as an independent for the state Duma, that's like their House of Representatives in Russia, you need 15,000 signatures in 42 days. 45 days. That's close to the old New York standard, which was 15,000 in 42 days. So it was 3 days easier. We've been talking to legislators in New York saying, let's at least get back to the Putin standard of, 15,000 in 42 days or 45 days, but 42 days. And they laugh and say, you're right. But so far, we don't have that bill introduced. We are working with legislators. We hope to have it introduced by the beginning of the next session in January. And, once we got the legislators introduce it, we can build a coalition and put a lot of pressure on the legislature to do it early in that session. Because after, those first few weeks, they're going to be focused on the budget, which is due on April 1st. And that's complicated. It takes the legislators' time. And then they got until just early June to do a deal with the rest of the legislation. And to have this ballot access petition corrected for 2024, you know, we'll be lucky to get it done, even if we do get a bill that passes it in January, because I'm not sure the legislators are going to want to change it for the 2024 election. They may say, well, it'll go into effect in 2026, which is the next statewide elections in New York. So that's what we're working on. We have a Green Party electoral reform working group that is working on that. And, you know, for me, that's a top priority, because right now the Greens cannot get on statewide ballots. I mentioned this before, but, you know, there were 8 attempts in 2022 under this new requirement. None succeeded, including the Green Party effort. The Republican, who has lots of money and could pay petitioners, didn't even do it. He was trying to set up another ballot line for his candidacy. You know, in New York, there's fusion, so you can run on more than one line. And he failed. So what he did, this was in the Republican headquarters in Albany, New York. They made photocopies of random copies of petition sheets they already had and sprinkled them into the petition until it got big enough to pass the 45,000 mark. They put in like an extra 12,000 signatures that way. Total fraud. They were caught with their pants down. You know, the documentation is there in the Board of Elections office, the petition, the fraudulent petition. So the Democratic / Working Families Attorney General in Albany said he was investigating. That was in November. It's a simple closed, open and closed case. And nothing has happened to this Republican candidate. And I think that's because there's kind of a silent agreement between the Democrats and the Republicans. It's okay, we'll let the Democrats say to the Republicans, we'll let you get away with this one. You owe us once for next time. It's the Democrats doing something shady. So I guess that's why we need a damn Green Party that's at least honest and not crooked like these other two parties. Scout Trooper 164, I think I'm going to drop X, which I think means what was formerly called Twitter. I'm really fed up with how far right leaning it's become. And there's a lot of stuff I'm following on there. And there's not a lot of stuff I'm following there. I just don't really care. I should probably be more active on X with my account, my Twitter account. I'm not a person to look through all my platforms every day. I mean, I'm on Telegram and Signal and WhatsApp and text messaging and email, and I'm kind of stuck. It's enough to get through email every day. So, Elon Musk is a right-wing asshole, and, you know, he is not running it as a completely free speech space. He's got his biases against the left that I'm hearing about. I can't recite the details. So I guess for me, it's like, what's the alternative? I know that some others, I guess Facebook or Meta, it's called, set up one called Threads, but I'm hearing people aren't satisfied with that. And something called Mastodon I haven't looked at. So all I can say is I'm still on X, formerly known as Twitter. And occasionally do look at things. And I find interesting stuff as far as the overall bias. It's just, I think it partly depends on, you know, who you're following. Their algorithms tend to feed you stuff you're interested in. So I haven't seen a lot of the far right crap except when it's pointed out to me and other, usually by email. So I don't know what to tell you. I mean, there's so much stuff going through the internet that if you drop out of X, you probably have plenty of content to look at anyway. So that's about all I can say about it. I guess it's up to you. Strong Flower. Hi, Howie. How can U.S. Greens get more media exposure? It seems the Democrats sabotage your campaign during election season. Still to this day, not enough Americans know that there's a third option. The Democrats, I think, you know, my media exposure was sabotaged more by the biases of both the mainstream media and in 2020, most of the progressive media, which really just were saying anybody but Trump, that's Biden, and we don't want even people to know that he could vote for the Green Party and Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker. So we were blanked out pretty much across the board with a few exceptions. Counterpunch at least let us publish stuff. And we got on some of the podcasts, but that was about it. So I think it's more the corporate media and also the so-called progressive media, which is into lesser evil politics more often than not. Now, how can we get media exposure? I mean, I've been able to find, and this goes from local up to state, if you have a campaign with real issues and you have, you know, press releases that are substantive and readable and interesting, you know, reporters are looking for stories. And then you got to be available. You got to respond. I mean, I've known candidates that say, well, I don't like this paper. Or I don't like that reporter, so I'm not going to respond. And so they get a negative story. In those cases, the least you can do is respond. They're obligated to give you a response, even if it's an attack on you. And so at least you get your side of the story to some extent out there. But mainly, I think it's about being, you know, candidates that are worth covering. And it takes some time to, you know, establish that. It took me years here in Syracuse before I remember I'd run for city council 3 times and then they ran me for county executive. And I didn't get mentioned by the newspaper until the day of the election. And it said the there was no Democrat. It was just me and the Republican. And it said the Republican has no opposition except from a marginal Green candidate. Didn't even name my name. But then after a while, I, you know, got into some debates running for Congress and, you know, the reporter said, damn, this guy, you know, has something to say and, you know, look pretty good compared to the competition from the Democrats and Republicans. And, you know, we've had other candidates have that experience. So locally, we established a reputation and we had good press releases, substantive press releases. I can remember a reporter telling me, you know, I love to get your press releases because there's actually some meat to them. The stuff they get from the major candidates are just fluff. You know, it's mainly announcements about they're going to be here or there to talk to people, photo op kind of stuff, not policy stuff, not talking about the overall dynamics of the campaign. So if you have good content and you can give the reporters a good hook, you know, that sort of gets the kind of thing they would use in a story to hook the audience in to read or watch the story. Another thing, when you do the media like you do a news conference, have good visuals, because the TV stations, that's all they care about. And it's really, for them, it's really more important what it looks like than what it says. I mean, many times people would tell me, I saw you on TV, you look good. I said, well, what did you think about what I said? And more often than not, they say, well, I don't remember exactly what you said, but you sure look good. So think about that when you're doing your media. So, and those visuals for the TV are good for newspaper photographers too. And of course, radio stations often run photographs with a text version of their audio report. So I think we can get a lot more media exposure, especially in local markets. And then from there you build up. I mean, when I ran for governor in 2010, I didn't get a lot of coverage till I was in a debate. With, you know, Governor Cuomo and a bunch of other candidates. And I really chewed out Cuomo, which got a lot of people's attention. And, you know, that led to some stories. And then when I ran in 2014, we got a lot of coverage, partly because the issues are breaking our way. You know, the public state of public employees are really mad at him. We got endorsements from teachers, locals, who were concerned about funding of the schools. And then there was the fracking issue, which a whole movement had built up. I mean, we're at the cutting edge of that in 2010. By 2014, it was very popular demand. In contrast to Cuomo, who formerly wouldn't take a position, but, you know, really didn't want to do it. And so we had another debate then. And, you know, I got stories like probably the one that got the most coverage was the Daily News, you know, that tabloid, the liberal tabloid in New York. had a full page spread about me being the Jolly Green Giant who was giving Cuomo trouble. And we did. We got 5% of the vote, the most for a third party on the left in New York in 100 years. And that was the only other time. That was the socialist right after World War One. And Cuomo had to come our way to compete for our votes. He had wanted to run up the vote to become a presidential candidate, get more than he got when he was first elected in 2010, get more than his father, Mario Cuomo, got as governor. And he got less. He had to compete for our votes. So we got the ban on fracking. We also got the $15 minimum wage and paid family leave, which he did not support until after the campaign. So that's just to say we can get media exposure and we can make a difference. But mainly, we got to be good stories for the media. So you need to think of it in those terms. And so give them quality stuff and always be responsive when you get the inquiries, even if it's a hostile reporter or columnist. You know, give them your side of the story regardless. Ashley R., U.S. Greens would be taken more a lot more seriously if they'd umbrella under the Dems and choose to be effective for once. Anything less is a counter-pro stunt and projection. Umbrella under the Dems? I mean, that's what the progressive left has been doing since the communists took them all into the Democratic Party and the Popular Front in 1936. And then the socialists did it in the 50s. And the left disappeared as an alternative. That's not effective. I mean, then we're just doing the grunt for Democrats. But at least in the 30s and the 50s were New Deal Democrats. Now they're neoliberals. So it's even less justifiable to do that. And, you know, COINTELPRO, come on. You know, that, you know, accusing the Greens of being spoilers is, you know, the kind of invective that COINTELPRO used to divide movements back when that thing was going, and still is with, it's not called that anymore, but we get a lot of examples of where they're intervening in progressive social movements, you know, the FBI. So, no, we need to be our own alternative and, you know, get our positions out there. And like I was saying earlier, I'm going to talk about this more tomorrow. We improve elections. I'll give you one example that I'll talk about tomorrow, but there are more, is, you know, 1948, Henry Wallace. You know, he was running to the left of Truman, and Truman was getting his ass kicked by Dewey until after Labor Day. Truman decided to pick up the domestic program of Henry Wallace, which was expanding the New Deal. And Truman caught up steadily until he beat Dewey on Election Day. And that's a case where Wallace didn't split the vote. He forced the Democrats to come out better than they normally do, which is why I say we improve elections. Just another example, I've mentioned this here before. In this congressional district, in the 50 years since it became a unified district in Syracuse, the only time a Democrat has won is when a Green ran. And we were accused of splitting the vote, but in fact, we forced the Democrat to deal with issues like Medicare for All and Green New Deal and taxing the rich. And instead of moving to the right to deal with the far right Republican, they had to, you know, kind of place themselves in the middle, which was better than they sounded when they were just running against a Republican. And they would move to the right to try to capture the vote in the middle. So I think, you know, we need to put our own positions out there, you know, to move the public and move the debate and move the politics. Amy L. Sachs, I would not laugh online. Democrats have never taken the left seriously, not in my lifetime, at least. I would contest that a little bit. You know, like when Nader ran, I mean, it's another example. When he ran in 2000, Gore was, you know, running on the old Clintonite, neoliberal, you know, kind of austere domestic policy. And the foreign policy was very, you know, militaristic. And Nader, you know, was polling, you know, up to 8%. And then after Labor Day, Gore came out with the slogan, with the people, not the powerful, and put forward some, you know, modest progressive reforms. And he was like Truman. He was way behind Bush until Labor Day, and then he started steadily catching up. And by Election Day, he won. Now, of course, Bush became president because of the Supreme Court, and they didn't fully recount Florida. Media went back and did the count and found that actually Gore won. But they found that out like a year later, and the news came out a couple weeks after 9/11, and so the media didn't really give it much play because they didn't want to undermine national unity in response to 9/11. But what I'm saying is Nader, you know, Gore had to take Nader seriously because he was getting enough votes, and it moved Gore and actually helped Gore do better than he was doing before that. So I think, you know, they take us seriously because they try to knock us off the ballot whenever they can. Because I think the Democrats know that our progressive policies are much more popular with a lot more people than their neoliberal austerity. So I think they take us seriously. They take us seriously enough to try to, you know, make us disappear. So I don't think we should underestimate our influence. You know, when I got 5% running for governor in 2014, you know, you could say I lost in a landslide, which I did. But, you know, for Cuomo, that was 5% he wanted, you know, for his own reasons. So in this state, the Republican, you know, hasn't won since early 2000s and the 1990s. And, you know, it's become much more, it's overwhelmingly Democratic. But still, they want to, you know, like in Cuomo's case, you know, get a high vote so he could make the case for running for president. So we have influence, and, you know, we force the Democrats to compete for the progressive vote. And to do that, they've got to move toward us. Or the progressives may say, to hell with you, we're going to vote for the Greens. So I would say, you know, we get taken seriously. They won't never admit it in public, but look at their actions, you know, particularly suppressing our ballot access. Ashley R. Green makes sense after the Nazis are stripped of power in public office. Only then. Well, that raises the question, how do you fight the fascists in this country? You know, the way the Democrats are doing it is by accommodating to the Republicans. Look at the House. Look at Biden saying he wants to do bipartisanship. When you say bipartisanship with the party that tried to overthrow your election, you're normalizing that far right. You're legitimizing them. And that's not how you fight fascists. You fight them by, you know, presenting a real positive alternative for people and fighting them, not making compromises with them. And what we see Biden doing right now is he's compromising on immigration. He's compromising on police reform. He's compromising on domestic spending, you know, that debt ceiling deal. And that just moves the whole country to the right. So I don't agree with that. I think, you know, we improve the political situation, the dynamics, by having our own voice, not just on the street, but in the elections. Because if we're just on the street, you know, the Democrats is who we're really trying to message, can just ignore us because we're not taking votes for them. If we can potentially take votes for them, then they got to take us into account and respond to what we're saying and the support we're generating for what we're saying. Vicky Corden, what is the worst of Project 2025? It is very scary. Yeah, that refers to, I think it's the Heritage Foundation and maybe the Federalist Society, I forget where it comes from, their agenda for the next Republican administration, meaning probably Donald Trump, or it depends on how his legal cases go, but I still expect him to be the nominee. And I haven't studied in detail, and there's been a lot of you know, commentary on that in the press, and I just haven't gotten into the details, so I can't tell you what the worst part is, but I can tell you generally it's anti-women's right to choose, it's anti-LGBT, it's not for defending, you know, the right of school and the teachers in the schools to develop curriculum that cover our real history. It tolerates book banning we're seeing from the far right. In terms of fair elections and access to the ballot, they're not for that either. They're going the other way. It entrenches, racial gerrymandering in districting. It's really bad. And then, the economics are, just going to exacerbate the extreme inequality that we've generated over the last 50 years. So it is very scary. I just can't tell you what the worst aspect of it is. I think it's all pretty bad. Blonde Boy Wilson, do we have a plan in place to get on the ballot in New York State? Well, the plan is what I was talking about earlier. We got to get this fair ballot access legislation passed into the legislature. Failing that, hopefully the Cornel West campaign will have enough resources, supplemented by the smaller resources of the National Green Party and the State Green Party, to get a lot of petitioners, a little army of petitioners out there to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days. It can be done. There have been actually more difficult petitions in places like Texas or initially getting on a ballot in California, which has succeeded, whether it was, the Peace and Freedom Party movement in 1968 or, Ross Perot. And that was generated just by, his campaign really didn't provide much financial support. He was like, okay, you get me on a ballot and I'll run. And people did. So I'm saying it's not impossible, but it's very difficult. So, plan A is to get the law changed. Plan B is to try anyway. That's the best I can tell you. Via email, comments on Senator Menendez being charged with corruption. I think he got away the first time he was charged. And again, I haven't read in detail, but, the summaries I've been reading say they got a pretty good case on this guy. And it's just, the crudest kind of bribery and corruption and, cash for favors. It goes on a lot more than we know about, in my opinion. I'm glad this guy is getting caught and at least charged, and we'll see what happens at trial. But I don't think it looks good for him. Scout Trooper 164, I see that Russia had their Black Sea Navy headquarters bombarded. Yeah, Ukraine, they're developing some real capacities. I mean, it wasn't just their Black Sea Navy headquarters bombarded, and it looks like, some of their high command was taken out in that bombardment, but they've been hitting military targets all over Crimea, and they've been able to do that because they had special forces go in and take out some of their anti-missile radar and their S-300 missile defense installations. So, that's pretty impressive. In fact, there's reports now that they a unit of Ukrainians went down to the Sudan and took out some Wagner forces that are fighting with the militia that's fighting the military. In fact, Zelensky ran into the military leader of Sudan, which is fighting this militia, in an airport. I think it was in Ireland. And they, talked to each other about that. The thing about that is, this military leader reneged on the agreement with the Syrian revolution, the popular revolution that overthrew the previous despot. And they had an agreement with the military that the military would restore order and then cede power to the civilian government and with new elections, and they didn't do that. They usurped the power. So, you know, but I guess if you're the head of a state, you got to deal with the head of a state. You can't, you know, get involved in an insurgent movement. And actually, I signed a letter today for a teacher who is a leader in this civilian pro-democracy movement, who's been detained along with a lot of other pro-democracy activists in this civilian resistance by the military regime. You know, the letter protested their detention and demanded their release. So, you know, that's a huge problem in Sudan. That revolution was very inspiring in 2018, 2019. It overthrew the government and you know, the military kind of stepped in to prevent the people from, you know, taking power directly. But there was supposed to be a transition, which, of course, the military reneged. And then the U.S. government is basically related to the military government, you know, on the theory that they can persuade them to reform and open up the civilian rule, which I think is, you know, kind of hopeless. But anyway, that's all to say that, you know, Ukrainians' military capacities for those kind of operations are pretty impressive. The frontline grind is pretty depressing to think about because, you know, as a lot of people have said, it's like World War I trench warfare. And it's very costly on both sides, and not much has changed, although Ukraine's made some progress this summer in its counteroffensive. And recently broke through some of those lines of defense that Russia dug in Zaporizhia in the south. Strong flower. There's a water shortage going on here in the Gulf Coast. Just a heads up to everyone. Yeah, I was not aware of that. I know the Gulf Coast gets a lot more rain than, say, the Southwest, but you know, I'm wondering what's the cause of that? Is it relative drought, or is it infrastructure not being taken care of, like in Jackson, Mississippi? That's just a question I have. But I'll take the advice of your heads up and find out more about that. The email, thoughts on the potential government shutdown. Well, like I was saying at the top, the Republicans are just, you know, shooting themselves in the head with this. They're the ones that cause these government shutdowns, and they get a negative reaction from the public. And some of them are just nihilists. They don't want to run the government. They want to blow the thing up, you know, the Steve Bannon stuff. And, you know, maybe their strategy is to, you know, wreck the government so Biden will be blamed. But I think it won't be hard to blame these, you know, crazies in the House Republican caucus. You know, I hope it's not a long shutdown because it'll inconvenience a lot of people and worse in terms of people needing essential services, emergency services, and not being able to get them. Disaster relief, I mean, from, you know, the wildfire, you know, Maui to some of these hurricanes. You know, people need help. And if the government shuts down, they won't get it. So it's a terrible idea. I mean, this is, you know, something that it's the least we can expect from our, you know, representatives in Congress. And they can't even get that done. Lenny Liff, are you going to run with Dr. Cornel West? I don't think so. I think he wants to balance the ticket with a woman for sure. And I already ran, man. give me a rest. I'm supporting Cornel as best I can at this point. I'm not looking to run. You know, I'm looking to be supportive in the background. Strong flower. Yes, Howie. The water shortage is due to saltwater intrusion into fossil water. Okay. Garrett Wasserman. Mississippi River is at some of the lowest levels in a long time. So ocean saltwater is coming up the river and threatening water in New Orleans area. And I imagine saltwater intrusion as sea level rises is a problem in some other coastal communities, perhaps Miami, which I know in high tides now, a lot of streets are flooded. And it is one of the first cities that's going to, you know, feel the effects of rising sea levels, the negative effects. You know, that goes to show the infrastructure. You know, this country is, you know, when I was in Korea for the Global Greens Congress and just riding their subway system, it was clean, it was fast, it was on time, it was safe. And, you know, such contrast to, you know, I was in the New York subway system over the weekend. And, you know, that's a great system in a lot of respects, but it's old. It's not as modern. It hasn't been modernized. It has tens of billions of dollars of repairs and improvements it needs. And we're just neglecting our infrastructure in this country. And that's sort of what the, you know, the rich folks want. It's like they can buy everything at the personal level. You know, they don't need collective goods that the rest of us depend on, public goods. And so this is a consequence of 50 years of neoliberalism. Really got going under, it's hard to date it. You know, Carter did a lot, and then Reagan accelerated that. But I think it goes actually back to Lyndon Johnson, you know, who's known for the Great Society. But a thing he did was, instead of building more public housing, decided to contract with private developers to build quote unquote affordable housing, which, you know, in the neoliberal theory is more efficient. In fact, it's more expensive, less efficient. And so this neoliberal turn from the New Deal policies, I think, began in the Johnson administration. But we're suffering the consequences now, whether it's, you know, water infrastructure or transportation infrastructure. Via email, should RFK Jr. get Secret Service protection? I think the government should, you know, provide protection where it's needed. And given the name and the history, I think, you know, that guy should get some protection. You know, aside from his own safety, and I don't like the guy, but, you know, just as a person, he should be safe. And, you know, if something does happen to him, that will reflect on our country and all of us. So, yeah, I think, you know, Secret Service protection in these presidential elections should be extended to more people. Right now, it's mostly the two parties, the two major party candidates. I don't even know if Ross Perot got it. And he was, you know, he got a double digit vote in the end. So, yeah, I think he should get it. Okay, I guess the banner signals we've run out of time. I saw a lot of stuff in the chat. I'll have to read it at the end. But the next thing, if you want to hear more from me, is that debate I was talking about that'll happen tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. It's called the Socialists in the 2024 Election. And I'll be arguing for independent political action. I think one other person will have this, you know, take that position in a different way. And I think the other two are more like, this time we need to, you know, support the Democrat to stop Trump and the Republicans. So it's a familiar debate, but this is a debate within the Marxist left. So that'll give it a spin that you won't hear on MSNBC. So can we put that in the chat again? Maybe you did, so people know. Yep, there it is. Okay. So, okay, I'll be back here next week. I hope to see you then, and have a good week. And hopefully the government doesn't shut down for long. It looks at this point like it's too late to keep it going before a shutdown. But hopefully they'll come to a quick resolution. Unfortunately, it's probably going to be a a resolution where the Republicans get something for their holding the, you know, the country hostage, which is, like I said, we got to fight the fascists, not accommodate them. So we'll see what happens, and we'll see you next week.